Hello, this is Terrence McNally. At a time when we might all be hoping for a particular biotech breakthrough, I can't promise a coronavirus vaccine. But the Harvard's Wyss Institute for Biologically Inspired Engineering is doing some remarkable cutting-edge work, including a freeze-dried, paper-based, low-cost, rapid test for Zika. Here's my 2012 conversation with founding director Don Ingber.
Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Pacifica Radio and Free Forum. After 3.8 billion years of R&D on this planet, failures are fossils. What surrounds us in the natural world is what has succeeded and survived. So why not learn as much as we can from what works? Nature, imaginative by necessity, has already solved many of the problems we're grappling with. Animals, plants, and microbes are the consummate engineers. They found what works, what is appropriate, and most important, what lasts here on Earth. As a piece of engineering, the human body is a marvel. It maintains its balance, even while executing complicated movements. It senses and adapts to heat and cold. Every 20 seconds, it circulates blood through even its most far-flung extremities. It has cells capable of replacing wounded tissue, finding and destroying dangerous invaders, and interconnecting to produce thoughts and emotions. Utilizing all these functions, our bodies and all living systems can accomplish tasks far more sophisticated and dynamic than any artificial entity yet designed by humans. In January 2009, Harvard University received the largest philanthropic gift in its history, $125 million, to create the Wyss Institute for Biologically Inspired Engineering, and today's guest is its founding director, Don Ingber. By emulating nature's principles for self-organizing and self-regulating, Wyss researchers are developing innovative engineering solutions for healthcare, energy, architecture, robotics, and manufacturing. I find this whole notion of imitating nature is one of the most exciting developments in our activity, and it is something that gives me great hope. On Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Don Ingber is founding director of the Wyss Institute and a leader in the emerging field of biologically inspired engineering. He also leads the biomimetic microsystems platform, in which microfabrication techniques from the computer industry are used to build functional circuits with living cells as components. His most recent innovation is a technology for building organs on chips, tiny, complex, three-dimensional models of human organs, and Don has authored more than 300 publications and 40 patents and received numerous distinctions in the field. Welcome, Don Ingber, to Pacifica and Freeform.
Thank you so much.
I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So could you briefly talk about your path to the work that you do today and go back as far as you want and feel free to cite mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing.
I grew up in New York, went to public high school. I call it Mesoamerica, the middle of Long Island, the first suburbs. I went to Yale as an undergrad. As many Yale undergrads, I pursued many different areas simultaneously. Everyone did a little of everything, so I had a passion for science, but I also had a passion for art and literature, and so my first turning point was, and I had another NPR interview years ago on this, was the same day I was culturing cells in a cancer lab for the first time. I was taking a sculpture course where I saw a structure that used a Buckminster Fuller building system that behaved just like the cell, and I said, "Oh, that's how cells must be built." And this was it's a system called tensegrity. It's sort of sticks and strings. The sticks don't touch, but it holds itself up against gravity, just like our bodies with bones and muscles. This is something that I've pursued scientifically for 30 years and actually been able to show is true. But what's important in this context is it got me to thinking about biology and cells from a physical perspective, a mechanical perspective. And I was also doing courses in how embryos form at the same time as an undergrad. And 100 years ago, all biologists, they didn't have genes. They didn't have chemicals and molecules. They had physics and mechanics. And so they explain development and how this embryo forms and tissues form in physical terms. And it explained an amazing amount. But then when molecular biology came in, sort of the baby was thrown out with the bathwater, and they threw out all those ideas, and everything was now was composition, you know, what things made of, what genes encode different things. And so I, for the last 30 years, have been pursuing the mechanical side of biological regulation, the idea that mechanical forces are as important as chemicals. And that led me to have to develop techniques and ask questions that required methods that were not biological. They actually required engineering. And so that's how my path to engineering, bioengineering, and now bio-inspired engineering, was coming as a biologist. I ended up staying at Yale doing a MD and a PhD simultaneously, and doing research in cancer, where I looked at cancer as sort of the breakdown of normal development gone awry, and again looking at physical changes in tissues as important, which now is actually being confirmed to be very important. I went to Harvard for my postdoctoral training with Judah Folkman, who is, I think, very well known for his work on angiogenesis and cancer. This is the idea that you can inhibit cancer growth by inhibiting the blood vessels that feed them. Mm-hmm. And he was on Time and Newsweek and on television a lot in the 90s. So he passed away a few years ago, unfortunately. But drugs that came out of that are now major blockbuster drugs in the cancer area. So I came up here to Boston. I got involved. Well, he's one of my major mentors. I have to say, because of my work with Buckminster Fuller, I got involved in that whole community. I met Fuller, have letters from Fuller that are kind of wonderful. I started with trying to figure out how to apply forces to cells and talked to people at MIT and got involved in developing new technologies that use magnetics at the small scale. I formed one of the first tissue engineering companies with Bob Langer and Jay Vacanti in the 80s. Got me more into engineering now with cells and trying to make artificial organs. I thought it was enormously exciting, but the challenge incredibly hard, and it's just really coming to fruition these days. I started collaborating with George Whitesides, who is a world famous chemist, and George was developing a technology called microfluidics, and this links to some of the work we're doing now, where he developed a cheap way to manufacture microchips for the computer industry, where you can, instead of using etching of silicon chips one off at a time, very expensive, well, not very expensive, but costly in the initial fabrication, he wanted to make a simple rubber stamp that could mass produce them. And so we started to apply microchip manufacturing to cells, because the great thing about microfabrication is you're controlling feature scales at the size that living cells live in your body, at the microscale. And we could show we can control cell shape and position and function and growth and migration by fabricating the little egg carton in which they sit, the size and shape of the little lacunae where they sit. And then George also developed ways to make microfluidic systems, and this is at the core of our organs on chips. This is a technology where you make miniature scale conduits in materials. You could think of like a canal or, let's say, a tunnel. And in that tunnel, you flow fluids, and people are using this because you could control them in a very regulated way, and you could branch them and mix them. They use that to miniaturize instrumentation in laboratories around the world. This has decreased the size and cost of major instruments enormously. We started to then use that to culture living cells. And so I'm going to stop here because I'm just giving you a path. But
right.
The point is that I never took a course in engineering in my life, but I'm a professor of bioengineering at Harvard University and the founder of this institute, and that's because I just learned how to follow paths that you need to follow to solve problems that you're passionate about. And what it taught me is I had to reach out and find people outside my field who can get equally passionate about the same problem and then collaborate. and actually be mentored by them and actually learn from them. And so this Wyss Institute is a place where we've actually tried to institutionalize this idea of multidisciplinary collaboration.
Yeah,
to harness the whole creative process.
Right. As I'm listening to you, I can see why you're at that institute and why you're the founding director. Let me tell people, I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking with Don Ingber. He's founding director of Harvard's Wyss Institute for Biologically Inspired Engineering, and that is a Swiss proper name, so it is spelled W-Y-S-S, Wyss. And you can learn more at wyss.harvard.edu. Let me just share a couple of things. One, my father, who passed away a couple of years ago, but he had multiple myeloma, and he benefited from that treatment that you were describing of the angiogenesis.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I also met Buckminster Fuller and made a documentary in 1973 of a World Game workshop that was done out here at USC. At which, of course, inspired by Buckminster Fuller, and then he made a couple of appearances there. So obviously someone who changes the way that you look at things.
Yes, exactly right.
Okay. When I described the Wyss Institute, pretty accurate in that description?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it goes beyond the science. I think we describe ourselves as sort of a new model for innovation, collaboration, and technology translation. And so the idea of the Institute is that in the past, engineering has been applied to solve problems in medicine, biology. They call it bioengineering, and it's transformed healthcare. You have hip implants and stents and pacemakers and drug delivery systems. But we were tasked with looking to the future, and we look around us and we see that I'm a biologist and I'm doing engineering and physics and computer science, and I see physicists who are doing biology, and the department at Harvard changed its name a few years ago to chemistry and chemical biology. There are many journals called that adding biology to their names, because this really is the century of biology. And so that, plus the fact that technology has advanced so much that we're really beginning to uncover how nature builds, controls, manufactures, all the way down to the nanoscale.
Yeah.
So what we see is a future where, rather than taking engineering trying to solve a problem, like in medicine, that we're going to leverage biological design principles, as you said in the beginning. Nature's figured it out.
Yeah.
We're going to leverage nature's design principles to develop new engineering innovations. And so that's why we call it biologically inspired engineering rather than bioengineering.
Sure, sure. Bioengineering is where the engineering aims, and what your biologically inspired engineering is where the engineering comes from.
Right.
Yeah.
And the other side of the Institute is that we are not just a research institute. We're focused on technology translation. Our measures of success include intellectual property portfolio, corporate alliances, licensing agreements, new startups, and having products in the pipeline in 5 years. And so, and we're on that track in all areas. And so, the donor comes from the business world, and basically said that big companies are great at product development, but it's really hard to have them innovate or change direction. It's like trying to turn a big tanker. Whereas academia does amazing things, but you know, you get papers out of it, and nothing really ever comes out of it oftentimes. So he wanted to see a startup in the midst of the world's greatest academic environment, and so that's what we've done here. We have actually a large number of people we've recruited from industry with many years of product development team management, who we've integrated with students, undergrads, grad students, fellows, faculty, clinicians, and we bring in corporate partners early on. We talk to investors and entrepreneurs, and once we get an idea and we see it has legs by these sorts of discussions with all these people who understand the competitive landscape, the real need in the marketplace or the clinic, we then essentially start developing it along the shortest path, de-risking it and trying to actually make it into a potential product that can be taken out and have impact on the world.
Yeah, that's the voice of Don Ingber, founding director of Harvard's Visa Institute. Now, it seems to me, and I think this is what you're saying, is that the notion of mimicking nature is innovative. The notion of being as interdisciplinary as you are within the university is innovative. The notion of being as interdisciplinary as you are with government and industry and product development is innovative. And in some sense, the Visa Institute and your work there is innovative and provocative on all three levels, yes?
I'm glad you're saying it, but we believe it is. I think it's a new model. It truly is. We have people visiting from around the world trying to understand what we're doing. And, you know, you can't do it without the freedom of a gift, the scale that we got, to be really candid. It's hard to work within a system and make little changes to make huge leaps. But we kind of started from a blank slate and leveraged the great part of academia, the skunk works, the creative freedom, and then brought in these different structures and created a corporate culture. My administrative leads came out of the startup world. They've never been in academic, you know, administrators. And so if you come here and visit, you'll see it looks like a huge startup. But we've grown from zero to almost 300 full-time staff in just a little over 3 years. So it's a startup on steroids.
Yeah, it really is. And let me ask one thing in terms of, if you will, metaphor. To some extent, being that interdisciplinary and that complex and having that many different channels working at once, that also imitates nature, doesn't it? I mean, the whole academic silos and separation is entirely opposite of nature.
Well, you know, I think to follow up on the Buckminster Fuller theme, Fuller once had a quote. He said, "Nature has no separate departments of, you know, biology, chemistry, physics, architecture, or art," and it's absolutely true. Nature also builds hierarchically. Like you have, cells, and they could live alone, or they could live together in tissues, and they could survive alone, or they could be integrated with other tissues to form an organ, and a bunch of organs, you get an organism, and down to the molecular level. And so I organized the institute. We did this collectively with, you know, as a bunch of faculty and the people that are come from my administrative team, the leadership. We organized it not the conventional way by, you know, problem area or individual faculty, but by what we call them enabling technology platforms. But we're trying to develop an enabling technical capability that would make a whole new class of technologies possible. And we built it around people, not around idea of, you know, a specific challenge. And the people were brought together because each one of them are so successful, they really don't need the institute on their own, but they all have problems they couldn't solve without additional expertise or resources or capabilities. And if you group them together in a sort of in a group dynamic way, in a synergistic way, in a hierarchical way, you begin to have groups that can do things they couldn't do alone and are excited to work together because they have a higher likelihood of solving their own problems. And then you have different groups working on different capabilities that crisscross. And so examples would be, We span more than we're not just medical.
Right.
One of the themes was that biology and medicine have scaled together for 300 years, but you know, architecture, manufacturing, materials for consumer products, that sort of thing has not been touched by the biology revolution. So we wanted to bring that in, but the other part is that expertise and methodologies and fabrication techniques that are currently used standardly in those areas are totally novel in the medical world, mm-hmm. and vice versa. And this happens all the time. We call it V-synergy, where, you know, we're trying to solve a problem. Like right now, we had a major grant opportunity, and they challenged us to try to develop fluidic systems. Think of it like a dialysis device that with blood flowing through it at high rate that you could do that without anticoagulant, without heparin.
Mm-hmm.
And so that basically the device itself would have an anticoagulant surface that would prevent blood from coagulating or clotting. This is like been around for 50 years. It's a huge challenge. It's basically everybody views it impossible, and we were able to get this grant because in a couple of weeks we took a technology that Joanna Eisenberg here was developing to prevent ice from sticking to airplane wings, and modified it slightly, and all of a sudden we had preliminary data that we can put human blood over this thing without anticoagulant, it wouldn't clot. And we just have millions of examples like that where, you know, across one platform, crossing one platform to another, that technologies that are being pursued for totally unrelated purposes turn out to have huge value.
Right, and that someone else or other institutions that do not have as much interdisciplinary cross-fertilization have no shot at that.
Yeah, I think the standard institutions have the standard structure is totally anti-hierarchical in a creative way, in the sense that there's a hierarchy but it's rigid. So you basically have the solo investigator who's funded as an individual, and then they tend to kind of protect themselves because in academia it's a very competitive environment. Space is is hard to maintain or to obtain, and then you have departments. And they have turf to maintain, and then you have schools, and that's all within the same university. This is true everywhere around the world, actually, and probably true in industry, too, in some ways. You have different divisions and so forth. So what we do here is we don't give the space to the faculty member. We have space organized around project, and we create what we call collaboratories, where people from different labs. Like, I have people in my group that are on different locations across our site because they're collaborating on different projects with different groups. So I think the standard structure that has evolved in academic research is one that's individual-based, and I think there's a strength to that in terms of you learn how to be an independent entrepreneur and you want to give creative freedom to individuals to pursue their own ideas. But the modern world is so complex, the problems we're facing, that you have to collaborate with others just to make major advances. I mean, there are very few single-author papers anymore. I mean, primary, research reports.
Yeah,
I can't remember the last time I've seen a paper with one author.
Right.
And there are papers that can have 100 authors, which people may not realize. And so, it really requires a new model to facilitate collaboration.
Yeah. I'm Terrence McNally, speaking with Don Ingber, founding director of Harvard's Wyss Institute for Biologically Inspired Engineering. And you can learn more at wyss.harvard.edu. And Wyss is spelled W-Y-S-S. Okay? This is exciting stuff. Let me just, because we've talked about it, I'm just going to say some of the institutions that are aligned in this institute, because it just confounds everything we normally see. Harvard School of Medicine, Engineering, Arts and Sciences, Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, Brigham and Women's Hospital, Children's Hospital of Boston, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Mass General, and University of Mass Medical School, and Boston University. And then my guess is what you're saying is on a project-by-project basis or a problem-by-problem basis, there's many more folks than that, because that's all the sort of academic institutions. Then there's the product development and corporate. Well, one thing I did want to notice was I looked at a lot of the – in your newsletters recently, a lot of your grants are – I saw even more than at least two from DARPA and so on, National Institute of Health, at a time when government is being slammed by too many people in this country – it seems that they're ones that are willing to get involved with you when you're doing sort of long-shot, high-risk sorts of things.
So let me just say two things. One is the other part of the institute, when you mentioned all the institutions involved, is I really felt strongly that we in America have a huge challenge for international competitiveness right now, that we're losing the edge. And I because I've done work in so many different fields, I mean, I'm well aware that Boston Cambridge has strength in all these fields, and that if we were to unite with other institutions, meaning academic as well as industrial you know, pharma, biotech, robotics, informatics, with all these universities up here, it'd be extremely hard to compete with us internationally. Or put it another way, we would stand out in a positive way internationally. And so we structured the institute with that in mind, and that this can't be, you know, just limited by the boundaries of ownership of the of an individual faculty, of an individual department, an individual school, or an individual university. And the donor was very, very much behind that. People may not realize that all those hospitals you listed are separate corporations. They're not part of Harvard. They're Harvard-affiliated hospitals. But they really are their separate entities. And so getting them to work together, there's a long history of them working together, but what we can do here is we can get them to work together where we can bring all the faculty from those institutions and other universities working at the same site so that they're side by side, and we can have one agreement with industry, and it really, really changes the way we all work together. So that, you know, is has really been incredibly enabling. Remind me what the second question was.
I noticed that the initial funding for a lot of, as I was looking at the newsletter, was DARPA or the National Institute of Health and so on, that government seems to be willing to get in, as I said, at the early stages of long-range, high-risk, you know, big gamble sorts of research.
Well, I mean, we have a large amount of funding from DARPA. Is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. It's quite an interesting group. They literally were formed very soon after Sputnik, mm-hmm. when America basically said we don't want to be surprised again like that technologically. So their role is to keep America ahead technologically for the defense of the United States. But defense could mean economic stability, it could mean medical, it could mean a broad range of things.
Right, it's a very broad definition of what national security and defense
exactly.
is.
Exactly, it's the broad definition of national security, which is really a strong America at all levels in terms of economic as well as infrastructure, et cetera. So they are tasked with keeping their eyes out for high-risk, transformative, paradigm-shifting technologies, or facilitating development where they see there's a need. So that's a natural mesh for us, and they're not looking for basic research. They're not looking for incremental improvements of existing technology. They're looking for breakthroughs that shift the game, because they're trying to solve, you know, huge problems, and they come at it at a whole new way, and it involves understanding at a deeper level. So it involves research, but it's really trying to develop a technology that can solve a problem. And so we have a very good funding history in our few years here that's extremely good with DARPA and ARPA-E is a new DARPA, but for energy. We've got funding from them in the energy area.
Yeah.
We have a grant, one of the first grants that the FDA gave out, the Food and Drug Administration. They decided that they need to start supporting what they call regulatory science, because the whole pharmaceutical industry is plagued by the problem that most of the drugs that take a huge amount of money and a long time to be developed and go through animal testing fail when they hit humans. Probably more fail than work.
After all that expense.
There's an inverse relationship between the way they're doing drug development and their measure of success. And I think the pharmaceutical industry is terrified about changing, because they know they have to meet FDA regulations in going through that process. The FDA realizes they're part of the problem, so the FDA really wants to come up with better ways to validate drugs during the development process, and particularly to replace animal testing, because we know that, you know, a mouse is not a human.
Right.
Judah Folkman said, when he had this anti-cancer drug that was curing cancer in mice, he said, you know, people were saying he had a cure for cancer, and he said, that's not true. However, if you're a mouse and you have cancer, we can take care of you.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's a big leap between a mouse and a human. And so that's one of the major you know, efforts we have here. But let me just finish the grant story. So I think there are portions of these funding agencies that are focused on higher risk work. In NIH also is got elements that are more flexible in their funding structure that are trying to do transformative things, but the large majority of money that goes to the conventional agencies like NIH and NSF tends to try to maintain high quality work and keep the engine of science going. And those, you know, are not really set up for our type of stuff.
Right, right.
And I have to say that, you know, that there's a cutback in funding across the board in these agencies that, in a time of international competitiveness, that's threatening the engine that drives the economy. And I think most people don't realize that science drives the economy. But if you think, well, what made America so successful the last 50 years? It was things like computers and microchips and optical fibers and medical diagnostics and therapeutics. That all came out of funding that, you know, the government actually ceded to academia in the, you know, 60s and 70s and 80s. And so I'm very concerned that, you know, and this goes beyond the type of stuff we do, that there's a contraction in funding for research because they think it's something that's, you know, just sort of funding academics pursuing their interests. But that's not really the case.
Yeah, well, I mean, DARPA's most famous technology is the internet, right?
Exactly. It was called the ARPANET originally.
Yeah, and people, you know, people probably are sending things back and forth in chat rooms right now, damning government funding in a technology that wouldn't exist without it. We're at the halfway point. Let me tell you, I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking with Don Ingber. He's founding director of Harvard's Wyss Institute for Biologically Inspired Engineering. And you can learn more at Wyss, that's W-Y-S-S, wyss.harvard.edu.
Hello, this is Terrence McNally. You're listening to my 2012 conversation with Don Ingber, founding director of Harvard's Wyss Institute for Biologically Inspired Engineering.
I first came to biomimicry as a word, a term, a field through the work of Janine Benyus, who I assume you probably have crossed paths at some point or not.
Yes, I know Janine.
Yeah,
yes.
And so yes. Janine came from it, you know, from this. She was basically she did field guides of Montana, looking at insects and plants and things, and then, you know, had this brainstorm that, my God, look at how nature, you know, has solved all these problems. And so I've been kind of following this field for 15 years. And I think 97 was the first time that I interviewed Janine. And I must say that when I saw the article, I think it was in the Harvard Magazine on the Wyss Institute, I said, wow, you know, this field has made it. You know, this is the mainstream. And what else is going on besides what you folks are doing? If you could just, you know, sort of lay out where biologically inspired creativity is happening and the state of it around the world.
So I do know Janine personally, and I know her book, and it's a wonderful book, and it's now, you know, 15, 20 years old, actually.
Right.
But she kind of went out there and pulled together the early seeds of what was going on in the field. She used the term biomimicry, which is a big part of what we do, but not all that what we do. I mean, we use the term biologically inspired because
right.
Biomimicry would be... you know, an example is that we just recently made an artificial insect cuticle. You know, the clear covering or the shiny covering of an insect, which, you know, you'd say, why do you want to make that? But it's actually an interesting material that has it's like the material has the strength of aluminum, but it's half the weight and it's biocompatible and biodegradable.
I read in your
stiff, depending on how much water content there is. Like insects have flexible, you know, hinges where the legs go into the body. And from a building material standpoint, you can imagine, wow, that could be interesting for you know, disposable bottles or biodegradable plastics.
And that's so what forth. I was thinking. Yeah, biodegradable.
So that's biomimicry. We actually mimic the composition and structure of the insect cuticle and get similar properties, but. Bio-inspired goes beyond that to, you know, being inspired by evolution and natural selection, right? You said that at the beginning of this, that nature has used evolution to come out with things that work over time by trial and error and selection. Well, now people can do this in the laboratory, and this is not just our group, but around the world, where you can evolve a molecule by making many variations and having cells that produce it and looking for better versions, or you could evolve a whole organism that manufactures drugs, for example. George Church here at the Wyss Institute has a technology where you can take the microbes that companies used to manufacture, you know, drugs like insulin or DuPont maybe uses for chemicals in the chemical industry, and they grow microbes up in big vats, and they collect their products and isolate it. And they're always trying to get, you know, decrease the cost of manufacturing. And one way they do it is they try to increase the efficiency of production. But they're doing it in a cell, a living organism. And so they use genetics, and they try to change one gene at a time. And they make mutations and say, is this better? Is this better? Well, we use a technique called directed evolution where you change many genes at once, and then you select for a marker that's a indicator of production, and then you look for the ones that are better, and then you do it again, and you do it again, and you do it again, and you could increase the efficiency in a period of days that used to take years, and at a tiny cost, you know, compared to what it used to be in the past. So that's something where we're inspired by a process, not a structure. So that you know, that's an example of you know, inspired versus versus mimicry, but there, this is going on around the world. I mean, my personal belief and why I did this and put so much energy is that this is the next technology wave. I mean, you've heard about genomics and genomics and genomics, and I think it's been tremendous. But, it, you know, the genome is sort of the inventory in that it encodes all the parts. And what we're interested in is how these parts are put together to build living machines that can move around and have functions and so forth. And that really becomes engineering. And so there are people around the planet, researchers who are developing, you know, artificial materials that, gecko skin. Geckos are known to be able to stick to a ceiling, you know, upside down. There are people that have made artificial gecko skins, and there are other groups that have mimicked shark skins because things don't stick to it, and they're using it in hospital operating rooms so that you don't get contamination. There are people making artificial bone-like materials and abalone shells. So the biomimicry, you know, at the level of mimicking a material is probably the more mature part of the field, and that's been around for a long time. But then there's, manufacturing of materials. There's harnessing living materials to create new structures. Like, there are people here at the Wyss Institute, William Shi and Peng Yin, also working with George Church and Sean Douglas, so that they're using DNA not as an information molecule but as a building material. And they can create, they could take a circle of DNA and add little bits of DNA that bind to known points in it and actually kind of staple it together based on the double helix formation. And so maybe people don't realize that DNA comes in a circular form, but many microorganisms have circular DNA. So you have a big circle, and then you have a little piece that pinches it like a staple so it looks like a figure eight. Mm-hmm. And then you have many other pieces, and you can code them to go where you want because you know all the little nucleotides, the ACTG that encodes DNA. And you add them together and you shake them in a test tube and it folds up like a balloon animal and you create any shape you want at the nanometer scale. And so whereas in the past, nanotechnology were taking materials from the inorganic world that are not really compatible in the body oftentimes and trying to develop nanotherapeutics, for example, these guys can now develop. Not only can they develop things out of biocompatible materials, they can make programmable robots that are at the nanoscale. They just had a paper in Science, part of the group, where they made little structures that are shaped like a clamshell that are snapped together by other DNAs that can recognize molecules on the surface of cancer cells. And when they bind the cancer cell, they open. The clamshell opens, almost like a purse clips opening and the purse plays open. And inside of that clamshell are shaped structure, are molecules that bind to receptors on those tumor cells and say and induce a suicide response, so it kills them. So this is a little programmable robot that looks around, will only bind to this cell type, cancer, not normal, and when it binds, it opens and it kills. But the rest of the time, the molecule that would induce killing is covered up because it's inside a closed container. So, you know, that's another bio-inspired, where you're like being inspired by how to harness how nature uses a DNA sequence to form a helix. And then it literally is building a helix in and making it fold in on itself to build structures. It's really creativity at an incredible level.
It really is. I mean, it's. I would imagine if someone just tuned in, like just before you started that description, they go, you know, what are they talking about?
Oh, they do that when they hear it in lectures and read papers, I think, because this whole field started about 5 years ago.
Exactly.
In California, Caltech, and in like 5 years, people are making, you know, one of our, Peng Yin, has made materials that can kind of take any shape you want. You could program them to take, you know, any shape you want in 2D, and he's now doing 3D. I mean, it is amazing even for me to watch how fast these fields explode once they hit a tipping point.
Yeah.
And you get enough creative people, and the creativity of the individual, the vantage point they each one brings. And then, you know, and then you mix together people and they riff off each other and come up with something totally new. And then here we're, you know, I think before the V's, that whole field was making cool shapes like artificial viral shapes or you know, a pulley on an axle that actually moves out of DNA. But here it's like, let's try to solve a problem. So we're going to make a cancer therapeutic. And that drove these guys in a very short time to come up with these programmable DNA robots.
So let me just ask you a couple of things. I've used, because I picked it up in preparing for this, the notion of high-risk research and so on. For someone who doesn't know what that means, what does that mean? Does that mean not necessarily a high likelihood of success?
No, this is a really good question. I mean, so high-risk is one where let me put it the other way. Okay, so the standard funding of research by government, like let's say NIH, when they review the grant, you have to have preliminary data to show it's quote feasible to reduce the risk.
Mm-hmm. So low risk usually gets the funding.
And actually, what has evolved over time, in the early days when there was a lot of money and there weren't that many researchers, you needed like a minimal amount of preliminary results. And, you know, they'd say, this is a good person, it's a good idea, let's give them money. What had evolved over time, it got so competitive and the money got limited and there were so many scientists in the field, you had to done almost all of it already. Now, to a scientist like me, it's not science if you've already done it. You know, you're supposed to be exploring the unknown. I mean, and so to us, that's low-risk research. The research that industry will usually do is, you know, incremental improvements. You already know it's working. You're just going to keep going until you get it a little better.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, high-risk is out of nowhere, a totally new idea, no real preliminary data, you know, good people, a couple of interesting ideas, and what if it worked?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, wouldn't that be amazing? And how would that change things? So, you know, huge risk, huge potential payoffs. I mean, that said, you know, I actually personally think that the highest risk research is when you only are so narrow in your focus that you put all your energy into one thing. And so I think by doing many different things, that's a different level risk, which when you the standard grant review would say this person is all over the place, or promotion committees would say this faculty member is too defocused, they'll never get anything done. But almost all of us at the V's in some way are just, you know, explosive in terms of our interests. We're all over the place. But what happens is something will work, and this is sort of the old venture capital model where they would invest in 10 companies, assuming that 9 would fail, but 1 would be worth a huge amount of money.
Right.
And what happens in reality is if you have really good people and really good resources, that actually almost everything works.
And my guess is
one of the criticisms I had early on was I had someone say, where are your failures? If it's high-risk research, where are your failures? You know, and the fact is that we've had a huge amount of successes. Of course, there are always failures, but those tend to be, you know, technical ones or, things you put on a side till someone else comes up with a way to get around them, or, you know, sociological, interpersonal ones.
Right, right. And I'm almost thinking that, well, two things in response to what you were just saying. One is that, again, that is the way nature works. Nature doesn't have a narrow focus. Nature is trying to eat, move, breathe, stay alive, yeah. All those things at once. And so, you know, it's always all over the place. In terms of evolution, we may not see it as we look at this moment, but over time. And the other is that my guess is with the creative people you have and the kind of cross-fertilization you have, a failure today when I'm applying something to X may be a success tomorrow when the guy next to me applies it to Y.
Yeah, and this is true, you know, this is good science. It's not just the sense that that's true about good science is that, you know, I always told my people, you know, if you have an idea and you hit a wall, you know, just make sure you write it down and come back to it. Or, you know, there are times I've been at a big meeting and I walked by a poster and I saw something that I thought could solve my problem, but I didn't have a way to deliver it. But I had it made and had it in a bottle on my desk for 5 years before I figured out how to deliver things like that. And then I tried it and it worked, you know. And so I think that's right. Sometimes the idea is ahead of the field. Sometimes the field is ahead of the idea. You know, you have to have the right group of people with the right capabilities. What the Vista Institute does is it allows us to do this at such a scale that it's rare that we don't have the right expertise around, and it's really just getting those people to interact and communicate. So we have people here from you know, major pharmaceutical companies, from aircraft manufacturing companies, from you know, computer research companies, from you know, medical devices, just the whole range, and they're sitting right near each other and interacting with each other when they have a problem to solve. And that's something they never had before, let alone the academic mix.
Exactly. Now, a question that I would think I'd usually ask earlier is just how did this happen? I mean, this fellow Vies and Harvard and you, and how, I mean, did he know what he wanted, or did he have, you get where I'm going. I mean,
yeah. Started about maybe 6 years ago, Dave Mooney and I, Dave is a faculty member here as well, were asked to co-chair a committee by the provost to envision the future of bioengineering across all of Harvard and all the hospitals. And about the same time, this donor, who was a Harvard Business School graduate, said he wanted to do something, you know, big, but he wanted it to be the future of bioengineering, not incremental stuff. He was interested in high risk. Again, he had been a CEO of a big orthopedics company, and he was frustrated by having them innovate. He saw bioengineering as sort of the future, because this is orthopedics, so he had kind of seen where engineering and biology and medicine intersect.
Mm-hmm. Sure, sure. Orthopedics is where that's obvious, right?
And so that was timely. And then, I had done some startups in the past, and I had actually had thought about other sorts of institutes, and actually biomimicry. I had put something together in the past that I think I used as sort of a core starting point. And but I was able to quickly with Dave and this committee, by reaching out and meeting with scores of faculty across all the campuses and the hospitals, pretty quickly come to a common vision that everybody was very excited about. And so it took a while, but working with the donor and putting together something analogous to a business plan, as if you were starting a company, we put together a plan that would start an institute that took into account all the challenges and mitigated the risks that we saw, which we considered from the beginning. But that said, it wasn't until after we got the gift that we really figured out how to do this. And that's all by what people you recruit. And it's like any startup, each person you recruit, the whole dynamic changes and the vision changes, but it's really self-organized in an amazing way. And I use the term self-organization. Our logo is a self-assembling one from a bunch of little spheres that self-assembles into these, because that is bio-inspired also. The process of growth by just having local interactions between many components that self-assemble into the most stable and functional system for that environment is what this has been all about.
Very good. I wasn't going to. That's the voice of Don Ingber. He's the founding director of the Wyss Institute of Biologically Inspired Engineering at Harvard. And you can learn more at wyss.harvard.edu. And Wyss is W-Y-S-S. I'm going to ask you again about some terms. One, you have a sentence where you say, we're adopting the same simple, ingenious design principles that nature uses to create new medical devices, to create new medical devices and biomaterials. And I notice simple and ingenious. What do you mean when you say that nature does that? And what do you mean when you say that you do that? Simple and ingenious.
Well, I mean, nature does take a palette of simple elements, whether it's molecules or cells, for example, and, you know, shakes them up, if you like, allows them to interact, and they self-assemble into structures that have functions. And then those structures self-assemble and make bigger structures with more complex functions. And those self-assemble, as I alluded to earlier, going from molecule to an organelle or the first microorganism, and then, you know, the idea of evolution that one primitive cell or microorganism engulfed another, and now you had a more complex cell, and then cells group together and make some simple organisms, and then those end up organizing into tissues, and tissues into organs, and then into an integrated, organism. The rules, the local rules, are pretty simple in that A interacts with B by binding to it and pulling on it, but also resisting it and coming into some kind of balance and form a new shape, and shape dictates function. So, you know, for the biologist, there are principles that at the local level are pretty worked out, and it's physics and chemistry. But you do that, and you do it in three dimensions, and you do it over millions of years, like you said at the beginning, and you select out structures that have functions alone and then different ones collectively, and all of a sudden, life emerges. And so, in simple and ingenious, I mean, the simple is that the rules are simple at the small scale, but what comes out of it at the top is absolutely ingenious in how well it's adapted to survive or manipulate even its environment. In terms of what we do, I mean, we try to keep things simple. I mean, let me use the example of the platform that I head, we call Biomimetic Microsystems, but the real simple way to describe it is organs on chips.
Right. I did want you to talk.
Organs on microchips.
Yeah, go with that one, because I think that'll be a wonderful example for people.
Yeah, I said that the FDA actually is funding us along with other agencies, because the FDA and the pharmaceutical industry know that the drug development model is broken. They spend a huge amount of money, a long time, and they waste a lot of animal lives, and at the end, they don't predict what happens in humans. And so they're desperate. Everybody's desperate for alternatives that you could actually model the human response. So what we're doing is, we're trying to engineer little bits of human organs and be able to test drugs in those organs to predict what happens in a whole human. But the way we actually do it, which I think is simple and ingenious, is we leverage the microchip manufacturing type approach, as I described earlier, where we can make a very small, and I'm talking about, let's say, a millimeter or less in size, tunnel through a material that's crystal clear and flexible, so we can look through it and see what's going on. And if you imagine, you know, in New York, like the Holland Tunnel, or a tunnel, you know, that you go through a mountain, in that tunnel, we actually cut it in half horizontally with a thin, flexible membrane made of the same crystal clear material. And so you now have a tunnel split in half by a flat membrane that has holes in it. And what we're doing here is we're going to mimic an organ, in this case, the human breathing lung.
Yep.
And the most important part of the lung is the air sac. And in the air sac, which is where you have, you absorb oxygen, where you have infections and pneumonias, where there's cancer metastasis, where, environmental toxins are absorbed, where aerosol-based drug delivery happens. It's very simple. It has air. It has one lung cell. It then has a supporting framework, like an egg carton made of molecules called the extracellular matrix that's porous. And then on the other side is another cell, the capillary cell that's in the blood vessels of the lung. So what we do on this little tunnel we cut in half with a membrane is we coat the membrane with these molecules of the egg carton, the matrix. We put human air sac cells on the top, and we flow air over it. And on the other side of that same membrane, just like in the body, we put the capillary cells, the capillary blood vessel cells, and we flow medium across it. And we can put human white blood cells in there as well. So we can, everything's human. And then there's a trick, because next to that tunnel, on either side are other tunnels that apply cyclic suction. And because the whole device is flexible, here comes the ingenious part, the whole thing's flexible, it actually, that membrane in the middle with the cells stretches and relaxes, stretches and relaxes.
Oh,
so we actually are mimicking breathing motions. And so we have airflow, we have blood flow, we have breathing motions, we've recapitulated the hierarchical assembly from cells to tissues on one side of the membrane, cell to tissue on the other, and then we've grouped them together so we have a tissue-tissue interface that defines the lung organ. And then we have inflammatory immune cells that are floating by. And with this little device, we have shown that we can mimic, you know, whole organism level response, whole organ level responses. So if we put a bacteria on the airway side, the white blood cells stick, just like they do in your body when you have an infection. They migrate through the capillary cells, through that matrix and the holes, come out through the epithelial cells, and then they engulf the bacteria on the other side. We have new data that if you give drugs that cause fluid on the lungs as the side effect, we see fluid shifting into the lung space. We're working with pharmaceutical companies beginning to screen drugs. We can now deliver aerosols into the top channel. And we've now recently published a peristalsing gut on a chip, like an intestine,
right.
Where it forms the villi of the intestine, and with a little bit of trickling flow, like in your gut, and peristaltic-like cyclic stretching, we get functionality never seen before. And we could actually keep microbes growing on the gut, where normally it would be a contamination, and we throw a dish away because they would kill the cell. But by having a little bit of flow and the cyclic stretching, we can keep bugs that come from human gut in the system, and actually we find that the barrier function of the gut gets better. And the bugs we put in there are the same bugs that are in yogurt that people take as probiotics that can increase, you know, gut barrier function. So we're doing this with many different organs now.
And I've got to bring it to a close. But I think that thank you for that one. And what you're saying is by doing it that way, you can test the reason the FDA is involved. You can test drugs, you can test pharmaceuticals in this lung on a chip, this gut on a chip. And link
them together eventually is the goal.
And get real results. Again, we've been talking about Harvard's Wyss Institute for Biologically Inspired Engineering. You can learn more at Wyss, that's wyss.harvard.edu. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to our podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly at my site or at iTunes. That's at terrencemcnally.net or aworldatjustmightwork.com or iTunes. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement, you can sign up at that site or by emailing me at temcnally@mac.com. Thank you to G, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi, Mark Maxwell in production, Matt Perez in traffic, and you, my listeners. And Don Ingber, keep up the good work.
Thank you so much.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1915. That was the day British socialist illustrator Walter Crane died. You have probably seen his Art Nouveau-style illustrations. Many celebrate International May Day, memorialize the Haymarket Martyrs of Chicago, or commemorate the Paris Commune. He also published a series of illustrations titled Cartoons for the Cause. That series was produced to commemorate the International Socialist Trade Union Congress of 1896. 1846. Born in 1845, Crane apprenticed with the Chartist radical William James Linton. He started his career illustrating children's books, nursery rhymes, and fairy tales. He later traveled to Italy with his wife Mary to continue with book illustrations and portraiture. Upon his return to Britain, he became friends with artist William Morris, whose pamphlet, Art and Socialism, deeply impacted him. Crane soon joined the Art Workers Guild and the Arts and Crafts Society. Together, he and Morris joined the Social Democratic Federation. Crane produced illustrations for its journal, Justice. From there, he helped to found the Socialist League and illustrated its journal, The Commonwealth. When the League failed to gain popularity, he moved on to the Fabian Society, whose members included George Bernard Shaw, H.G. Wells, and Sidney and Beatrice Webb. Crane produced wildly popular images, like the Angel of Freedom, and published The Claims of Decorative Art. In it, he asserted art could not flourish in a world where wealth was so unfairly distributed. Only under socialism could use and beauty be united. He continued to publish and became principal of the Royal College of Arts in 1898. A strong critic of the British Empire, Crane supported the Labour Party and produced posters each year to celebrate May Day. Labour History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labour History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.